Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless.
Fifth grader Amy Mihaljevic went to Bay Village Middle School on Friday wearing green pants, a lavender and green sweatshirt, and carrying a denim and red backpack. Police found Amy's bike locked up at school, but they haven't found Amy.
Well, we're doing this to show Amy that we're all hoping for her and hoping that she gets returned home safely. And I know we're all sort of scared, you know, and that something like this could really happen in our community.
This quiet, upscale community is totally unaccustomed to this type of trauma. The Mihaljevic abduction is on the minds and lips of everyone in town, and authorities fear that with each day that passes, lessens the likelihood of her safe return.
Amy's abductor has been described as a white male, 35 to 45 years old, approximately 5'8", and wearing glasses.
I, in fact, would like to ask anybody in the Cleveland area to light a white candle for Amy each day. I think it will help light her way home. If there are candles burning all over, she's got to come back. She's got to come back.
It was anything but business as usual today at Bay Village Middle School. Shortly after leaving here last Friday, 10-year-old Amy Mihaljevic was abducted.
Whoever is responsible is out there. We know that they have a great interest in what's being covered in the media. And we certainly don't want to do anything to tip them off as to the course of direction of our investigation.
A number of law enforcement officials, including the FBI, were here for tonight's memorial service. In addition to paying their respects, there was also the gruesome outside possibility that Amy's killer might be among those who came to pay their respects. Bay Village Police and the FBI aren't thumbing their nose at any clues, including the remotest of possible leads. Right now, time is the enemy, as the abductor's trail grows colder by the day.
There's frustration because the murderer hasn't been found. There's a lot of anger over that, too.
Amy's posters up all over town will eventually come down. So will the ribbons tied up for Amy that are now worn and torn.
Hello and welcome to episode 101 of Who Killed? My name is Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media podcast. On this week's episode, we're going to take a look back at my last interview with Chief Mark Spetzel of the Bay Village Police Department. And now, he was the officer that spoke with Amy Mihaljevic's class on the day that she was abducted, and then he eventually became the chief of police. Now, since then, he has retired, and this was probably one of the last interviews he gave about the case, and it is interesting to hear his perspective 30 years on, investigating this case, and it's always intriguing to hear from an actual officer who was boots on the ground and involved with the day-to-day operations when it came to investigating this unfortunate murder. So, again, this is an interview that I conducted with Chief Mark Spetzel when he was still the chief of police at Bay Village, and he, again, has since retired. And in this episode, we do talk about what his possible future employment situation may be. So hopefully things will work out and he will be eventually back on the case. But that is yet to be seen. So until then, enjoy this interview with Chief of Police Mark Spetzel of the city of Bay Village.
Well, I've got an extensive collection. So I've been with the department almost 34 years. So I was here and a young, relatively young officer at the time that this crime occurred. And as a patrol officer on October 27th, 1989, I had actually spoken to a class at the middle school and later learned that Amy Mihaljevic was in that class the same day that she was later abducted. So my connection goes back to the very beginning. And then at some point after, we're just going to fast forward here. I became a detective lieutenant, was put in charge of the detective bureau, and then it became case fell under my purview. And so for the next 15 years or so, I was the main investigator along with past investigators and the FBI on the case. So, and now as police chief, I oversee all that, and as you and I have discussed in the past, a little frustrating because you can't work the case like you'd like to now as a police chief because you have other responsibilities. So I've been there since day one, basically.
Yeah, literally.
Literally, yeah.
Literally since day one.
Yep. It was from 1999 through 2013, basically. And what I would, well, of course, you had other cases. So we had the Mihaljevic case always out there, obviously has not been resolved yet. So you have all your daily other activities, other crimes, whether they be, you know, burglaries or rapes. And we've had a couple homicides during that time. So all that goes on. But in the background, you always have the Amy Mihaljevic case. And it's a case that comes up often daily, depending on what you're doing with the case. And if not daily, weekly. So there was always something happening with the Mihaljevic case during that time period. There were time periods during the investigation where we would do a major focus on some aspect of the case, whether it's revisiting the facts, whether it's, you know, we talked about DNA in the past, or whether it's looking at a certain aspect of something and really drill down on it. And during those times, we'd spend days just doing that, doing nothing but the Mihaljevic case for the whole day. And that's not only me, but that's the other detectives, that's prior detectives, that's the FBI, and it's, you know, it's labs, it's everybody assisting. So the case has always been moving forward, and it's sometimes heavily and other times just maybe weekly, following up on a tip that comes in.
More glacier-paced.
Yeah.
Now, did you guys have any leads down in Ashland County area? I mean, were they, as far as the authorities go, were they, did they work with you guys at all as far as, you know, tips when the body was found? And
so we established a secondary kind of command post down there with the FBI and Ashland County Sheriff's Department. So we actually separated leads. So leads were always coming in up here in Northeast Ohio. When the body was found down in Ashland, we set up the secondary command post, and leads started coming into that. And there were a lot of leads that came into that, obviously, because that's where the body was found. Obviously, they were all still coordinated up here with our organization, but a lot of leads that came in down there were followed up by agents, sheriff's deputies, FBI agents who were working down there, as well as we had at least one officer from our department and local FBI working in assistance with that. So it was always a coordinated effort to do that.
So you guys always had worked together?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And just regardless of what organization, we've worked with many, many other law enforcement agencies on this case, because they'll provide us information, or maybe we need their assistance with something. So
now, I know that we've talked about DNA in the past, and we haven't gotten, you know, you're not obviously not going to get into specifics, right, about what you have, but when was it that you realized that you had it? And now, in 1989, were you conscientious of that at that time? Because it hadn't been used in trial, right, yet.
DNA was certainly in its infancy back in 89. It was nowhere near what it is today. But even back then, you know, everybody knew that blood evidence was important, you know, even then. So you have a body that is recovered in a field that's decomposed. You understand that a lot of the forensic evidence has probably been deteriorated, lost, you know, just from the period of time, the weather conditions and everything else. So, but you treat that body scene, recovery scene, as a crime scene, and you try to collect everything you can. So they did that. They did their due diligence there as far as collecting any evidence. Just like as we sit here today, we have no idea what the technology is going to be 15 years from now.
Right.
So if we respond to a homicide now, there are things that we probably will do. And 15 years from now, we'll look back and say, well, we should have maybe done that. Well, we didn't know. We don't know what that technology is going to be. But we all know that the sensitivity of DNA is only going to improve. You know, we have touch DNA now, where certain cells, just from a person walking into a room and touching something, now leaves DNA. So you have to, in your mind, you have to say to yourself, we have to protect this scene to the best of our ability, because we don't know what that's going to be. And I believe they did that back in 1989.
Yeah, I mean, with the high profile case that it was, I would think that they kind of dotted their I's and crossed their T's in many different ways.
Right.
Now, as far as when they went down to the scene the day that she was found, do you know how many officers and people were down in that area collecting evidence? And
I don't know the exact numbers. I will tell you that by prior arrangement, if it was determined her body was ever recovered, that the Cuyahoga County Medical's officer, coroner's office at that time, would do the autopsy. So that was predetermined. So when it was determined it was her body was transported to the Cuyahoga County coroner's office. The Ashland County Sheriff's Office was responsible for maintaining the crime scene down there, and they did a really nice job of that. It was maintained, gosh, I can't give you an exact, at least a half mile radius around where her body was found. Because it was their jurisdiction, they had primary jurisdiction there, but obviously they knew it was our crime. So we assisted, the FBI assisted, the Ashland County Coroner's Office, the Cuyahoga County Coroner's Office, the Ashland County Sheriff's Department. All of them were involved in that search of the scene, recovery of the body, and subsequent investigation of that area.
And that's when you found the curtain and the blanket that came out in 2016.
Right, because we collected virtually everything around that crime scene, and those were found, you know, down the road as the wind blows and as the water flows. It was found down the road, so those were collected at that time, along with other pieces that probably have no relevancy, but you don't know. Again, we look back and we say, well, I wish we would have done that. They collected everything that didn't naturally grow there. They collected it.
Yeah, you said how many bags or boxes?
There were hundreds of items just collected from that area. I do not off the top of my head. If I'm looking at it, I think it's probably about 3.5 feet by about 5 feet.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a homemade blank, or it's a homemade curtain made out of what looks to be like a bedspread.
Yeah.
Very unusual. It's not something you'd buy in a store. It was handmade.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody made this curtain, and I'm sure it has a match somewhere, or had a match somewhere, which is why we put it out publicly. You know, it's such a unique item that hopefully somebody would recognize it. Now, we've not had that exact match. You know, it's never come across our plate yet, but we're still hoping for that.
Now, as far as the blanket goes, same connection, though, with the as far as the dog hairs?
No, just on the curtain itself. The blanket didn't have any connection, but it was found in the same relative area. No, just other than the same exact area.
Vicinity.
And you think about the fact that, you know, these could have been lying there for we don't know how long, months and months, right? Exposed to the elements. Well, DNA is sensitive. It is easily destroyed. So anything out in the elements has potential for being destroyed. So one of the things we look for is there a potential down the road with some new technology where we're not identifying DNA on this item currently, but in the future will it be such a sensitive test that we can identify something we couldn't identify today? So that's why you keep all that stuff. That's why you reanalyze it, which is what we've been doing over the years. Every time there's a new breakthrough, we're looking for another avenue to pursue as far as forensics and DNA.
The first time that we talked, I think that cases were starting, I think the Golden State Killer had just been solved, but it did feel like cases were being solved on the regular, and I felt like Amy's case might be one of those cases. You know, after a year of that, are we still waiting for the technology?
Well,
that technology isn't what's going to solve this case?
The technology of today isn't what's probably going to solve it for us. We're still looking for the technology of tomorrow, but we know it's coming. We know that they're advancing rapidly. And the other thing is you got to be careful you don't destroy all your evidence, you know, pin all your hopes on one possible technology.
Right.
Because if you get rid of all your evidence, then what if you have, you know? And so you got to be really careful on picking the right time, being very judicious in the use of your technology, because you want to, when you do it, you want to make sure it's right.
So currently the familial genealogy that's been used to solve these other cases isn't something that could be used currently.
Well, not current, in the future, possibly.
Right.
But where we stand now, no.
Okay.
You know, it's a very complicated. I don't want to get into all the details of it, but because, you know, it's like when when you have this coded database, right? You got all these convicted criminals with their DNA in a database. You would think, well, you have a crime scene. You just pull off DNA that is unknown to the victim, and you plug it in the database. You solve the crime. Well, it's not always that simple, especially when you have a body that was lying in a field for an extended period of time, exposed to the elements, and a lot of the potential DNA probably got destroyed, you know, or contaminated or whatever the case may be. So that complicates things. If you have a crime scene that happened yesterday, that's a whole different story. And then again, over time, even if you collect it properly, we're talking 30 years that DNA has been sitting around, and even that deteriorates in the best of conditions. So again, you got to be really careful.
So when the body was found, was it the Cuyahoga County coroner that actually removed the body then, or was it Ashland County?
Ashland County coroner's office removed the body. It was transported up by private ambulance up to Cuyahoga County.
Always wondered, just because I know that Emory, I mean, the one autopsy report or coroner's report that I've seen, as far as the cause of death goes, I mean, it looked like blunt force trauma and, you know, a couple stab wounds to the neck, and then she bled out. Is that what basically...
The blunt force trauma, they never really determined if that was fatal or not. Probably not.
Okay.
But, you know, we don't know if it was... If the blunt force trauma was before she was stabbed, after she was stabbed. In other words, you could be stabbed and fall to the ground and hit your head. And if it's at the same time and your heart's still beating, you can't necessarily tell that that bruise or that that trauma was caused by before or after that event. So it's very, very close. Perimortem. So that's really not been determined. Definitely the stab wounds were the fatal part of that crime.
And to create like a stab wound that would, I mean, basically they must have cut the carotid artery or, and it doesn't take a big knife to do that.
So this is a pretty devastating, there were a couple stab wounds to the neck and they were pretty devastating injuries. And
hey, fellow true crime aficionados, I've stumbled upon the ultimate hidden gem, Dakota Spotlight by James Woolner. It's a revelation. Picture this. Thoroughly researched, original, and peppered with real interviews. No sensationalism here, just gripping storytelling with heart. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and you'll always want more. So cozy up and join me on the edge of your seat. Trust me, this podcast is the real deal. Start with the Mandan murders and prepare to be hooked. Let's uncover this treasure together. Listen to Dakota Spotlight.
Well, again, deterioration, decomposition, you know, but it wouldn't have taken a large knife. We don't think it was a large knife or anything like that. It wouldn't have taken much to do the damage that occurred. You can tell, I think the wounds indicate it was a personal crime. It indicates, well, the crime itself, if we go back to the abduction and things like that, the individual who did this was very calculating and planning. They really planned the event out. They groomed her.
Do you think that her,
you know, able to get her there, But
was
I think
it
what happens in
like
these
impulsive?
Cases is they have different
like the way that
vision
it,
of what a relationship's going to be
like
with
that...
a child than you and I would ever perceive it to be, and those never work out, of course. And so we believe it was a sexually motivated crime, the kidnapping and the abduction and the eventual murder. So something happened. Didn't go the way that he expected, and he had to kill her. And, you know, that's what we believe happened. And so there's a personal aspect to that type of crime.
And that is a perfect segue to introduce this week's sponsor, BetterHelp. Having dealt with anxiety and depression for most of my life, I know a thing or two about the importance of mental health. So today I'm pleased to tell you about a great company. Is there something that interferes with your happiness? Or is preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can get help on your own time and at your own pace. And now you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. With over 3,000 U.S. licensed therapists across all 50 states, BetterHelp is there for you. If you're not happy with any of your counselors for any reason at any time, you can get a new one for no additional charge. They even have apps for your computer or smartphone. Whether you're suffering from depression, anger, stress, anxiety, LGBT matters, or self-esteem issues, they have a licensed professional counselor for you. And everything you share is confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic listeners get 10% off your first month with discount code WHO. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/WHO. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/WHO.
That's interesting as far as the personal aspect of it goes, because he groomed her, but... If he didn't know her.
Yeah, obviously we know there was a call or calls made.
Yeah.
And that process of grooming occurred. And we don't know over how many calls. We know at least one probably more. But this is an individual that is that excels at grooming kids. Because you think about Amy, who, you know, had a fairly protective mother. They had a password if anybody was going to pick her up. She had to call home every day after she got home. These are indicators that they knew that there's dangers out in the world, and they're doing what they can to protect their daughter. Yet still, Amy, despite that, meets a stranger. We don't know what it was in her mind, but for us it was a stranger, and goes shopping. And so that's quite a change from her normal behavior. So he had to have made her feel very comfortable to get in that car and leave with him.
Yeah, that really leaves a lot of question into how he could have gotten that trust so right. quickly.
And that's probably through grooming that he has had prior practice doing, which indicates he's probably has other attempts or he has other crimes that he's committed where he's groomed young children. So that's why we always look at past crimes, you know, to see if there's anything or crimes that occurred after the fact that match up with ours, even remotely. This is probably an individual that started making phone calls. It could have been sexually motivated phone calls. It could have been voyeurism. There's all kinds of precursor criminal behavior that he could have been involved in. So these things are always looked at. When we get a tip or lead, we're always looking and doing background work to see what other activities they may have been involved with.
Yeah, that's one of the cases, one of the MOs that I've, like, yet to see at least repeated since then. I mean, I know technology at that time was changing pretty rapidly as far as the phone went. And, you know, obviously things could move online, and that's a whole other ball of wax. I did come across a story in Toronto, though, that happened 3 years prior to Amy's, which was the Allison Perrott case.
Okay.
And she was called at home, groomed, told that he was going to conduct he was a reporter or a photographer and wanted to take her picture for the upcoming track event. But she was 11 and, right. you know, same exact end result.
Yeah, and that's the type of behavior that these individuals during that time frame would have exhibited. And as you said, today, that'd probably be the internet. They'd be using the internet to contact and make those connections. And before the telephone and all that, it was playgrounds, you know. And so as things evolve, their methods evolve. And, you know, there's a very good possibility that this individual who groomed Amy and made the phone call has moved on to the internet or something like that. That's very possible.
You started in what, 85. Okay, so that was like the heart of Stranger Danger. Mm-hmm. And where did the whole Stranger Danger
yeah, I don't,
and all that stuff
I don't know what the case or cases were that did that. I really have never looked at that, but certainly, you know, anybody who's ever been a parent, your number one responsibility is to keep your kids safe, right? You know, have them grow up to be safe. And I think when you start hearing about these cases, of course, today's media, you hear about everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, true or not, you hear about everything that goes on out there, and it makes you even more aware. So I think that was just beginning back in that time frame.
Just more communication between...
Just more avenues of communication and more stories being out there. You know, crime has always occurred.
Right.
It's always been around. It's just how it's presented to the public and how they find out about it has changed dramatically with social media and the instantaneous news and everything else.
I definitely feel like, you know, with the coverage, I mean, just in the 80s, being a kid that grew up in the 80s, I mean, it was like Stranger Danger was every day. It was, you know, this, that, and the other. And, I mean, I know that there were cases like, you know, Adam Walsh, And then you guys actually had John Walsh come up and do
he did a
segment on America's Most Wanted.
Correct.
You know, it's one of those. I mean, it has to drive you nuts. I mean, not to say what everybody is thinking, but you know, to sit here 30 years later.
So there's a level of frustration because we feel like we've done everything that we could possibly do. We devoted resources from literally the minute she walked in the door and said her child was missing. An extraordinary amount of resources were developed. So it's not like you look back and say, man, we just didn't do a very good job on this. We didn't do this. We didn't do that. We did things that were cutting edge at the time, let alone everything that you would normally expect. And we devoted a ton of resources to it. We're a small department, 24 officers, mm-hmm. but the fact is we had the assistance of the state and the federal government and every surrounding law enforcement agency helping us. So we had this force multiplier. So it really wasn't just because we were small, we couldn't do it. We had everybody assisting. So we had the resources. We had the manpower, and we utilized all of that. So the frustration comes in is you did everything you possibly can, yet it's still not resolved. That's where the frustration is.
Yeah, and one of the podcasts, excuse me, that inspired me to do a story about Amy was In the Dark, and they covered the Jacob Wetterling case, and you know that happened like 4 days, 5 days prior to Amy's, and it was a young boy riding his bike, and that was a case where the department dropped the ball, and like you can they actually interviewed the guy and looked in his car and moved on, and you know it was one of those things that like it came up, and it's not to say that like if Amy's killer is eventually caught that his name won't be found in the database.
Oh, it could very well, because we have literally thousands and thousands and thousands of names, you know, so it's very possible that could be the case. Sure.
Yeah, and so that was a pure, you know, a case of they didn't do it right. So it does have to be agonizingly frustrating for you to be just knowing that you dotted your I's and crossed your T's and had the FBI here literally the next day.
And that is it's not only frustrating for current investigators, but past investigators who poured their heart and soul into solving this and, you know, went on and had to leave their service without doing that. And and there's been a few of those, and certainly that affects them as well. But they're people that will always come back, and I'm in contact with a lot of them. They'll always come back and help. If we said, hey, you know, you worked on a part of this and, you know, it's come back up, do you mind coming in? Well, they'd be here in a second. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into where things stand with Torsney. And, you know, especially just Torsney and his involvement.
So Phil Torsney had been working on it. He was on the case back in 89. He worked an aspect of the case. And, of course, his job was not the Amy Mahalovic case back then, but he worked on a good part of it. Continued to work on it throughout his career, even up through retirement. And he's come back and helped us. And he's been a tremendous asset. He's a dogged investigator, great guy. He's definitely somebody you want on your team. So we've had the ability to utilize his expertise and knowledge, and he's been a great asset for us. And he'll continue to work. He'll continue to do what he can to help us.
So when a case transfers from one agent to the next,
there has been
do they get
years.
Like a refresher
that
on the case?
Has changed
and do they like
time,
come in and talk to you and say, hey, this is I'm
so
the new
we
guy?
We have a point of contact at the Cleveland office.
Now, as far as the grant money goes?
Grant money has run out. You know, the city has helped pay for some of his services as well, and we'll try to continue to do what we can. But, you know, there's no unlimited pot of money anywhere for anything. So we do what we can. We certainly see him quite a bit and talk with him.
Yeah, I was wondering what that kind of relationship was.
It's a good relationship, and it's often agents we knew before.
Okay.
But as they get promoted or move on or get transferred, whatever it is, somebody new is assigned. And often when that new person is assigned, it's somebody we know, you know, in the Bay Village Police Department, because we know the agents, a lot of them anyway. And so we're already familiar with them. And generally, they're all familiar with the case, too, because they have, if they get a tip that we need their assistance, it's not just one person that helps. It's whoever in the office can help.
Right.
So the case is well known in the Cleveland office. Okay. Amongst the team there, and so everybody's familiar with it. It's just that there is one person assigned as the point person to coordinate the activities and help with the investigation.
Thank you so much to Chief Mark Spetzel and the Bay Village Police Department for allowing me to interview them about the Amy Mahalovic case. And again, this is an unsolved murder of a 10-year-old girl that is currently now 31 years old, and it is about that time that somebody steps forward and confesses or turns somebody in. But please, if you are familiar with anybody involved in this case, please contact the authorities at the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234, or you can contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. And again, I drop new episodes of Who Killed every Friday. And If you guys are interested in supporting the podcast, you can do so by clicking on the donate button on the left-hand side of slowburnmedia.com, and that is slow minus the W. You can also contribute to the show with the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. There will also be a link in the show notes for you guys. And I am serious when I tell you that every contribution, big or small, really does help keep these Slow Burn podcasts on the air. And if you want to leave a review, that helps as well. So wherever you listen to your favorite shows, those 5 stars help keep the cases that I cover in the spotlight. And if you'd like to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have in the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. Thank you so much again for listening. And until next week, be healthy and, of course, stay safe.
I want to take a moment to tell you about my podcast, Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage. In 1984, a woman named Phyllis Cottle was abducted in broad daylight, tortured, and left to die in a burning car in Akron, Ohio. At the time, I was a rookie reporter covering this horrific story. Since then, I've reported every kind of crime imaginable. I've been able to leave most of them at work, but not this one, the one that buried itself under my skin and stayed put. Phyllis Cottle was a badass woman, and I want to tell you her story. A production of Evergreen Podcasts and signature title of the Killer Podcast Network, you can find Carol Costello Presents Blind Rage wherever you get your podcasts. Discover more great true crime and paranormal programming at killerpodcast.com.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine. From history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and...
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts. And on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.